I had so many people telling me like, oh, really struggling. I'm just like,
This is
I'm
great.
having the best time, sorry.
Melanin and me, exploring the Black woman's experiences in Britain. Hey, lovely ladies, welcome back to Melanin and Me. Before we dive into today's episode, we want to remind you how you can stay up to date with our latest content. We release episodes every other Thursday, so make sure to subscribe to Melanin and Me on your preferred podcast platform so that you don't miss out on any episodes. You can also follow our inspiring content on social media by searching Melanin underscore and underscore me on Instagram, or find us on Facebook at Melanin and Me UK. If you felt empowered or motivated from any of our episodes, we love to hear it, so feel free to contact us by emailing melaninandme@yahoo.com or slide on in the DMs on our social accounts. Don't forget to share some love, drop us a review, and share with any of your fellow queens who might be uplifted by tuning into Melanin and Me. For now, enjoy today's episode. Hello, lovely ladies, and welcome back to another episode of Melanin and Me. And today we have a wonderful guest with us. She is Associate Director for Children and Young People's Mental Health. Kadra, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hi, everyone. I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
We're all good, and we're excited to talk all things mental health. I think this is the first episode we've really dived into mental health since we started, right, Ray?
I think so. It's been a long time coming. I feel like it's been festering, and we've been excited to find just the right person, and I feel like you're the perfect suit, being Melanie.
Kadra. Yes.
Thanks, guys.
So Kadra, we know that you do many things in the sector, in your community. Like, you wear many different hats. To be honest, I don't even know like how you juggle all the things that you do. For our listeners, just tell us a little bit about yourself and the many hats that you wear.
Yeah, sure. So so I'm Kadra, as you said already. My main role is at a charity called Center for Mental Health. We're a small sort of mental health research think tank. And basically what that means is that we carry out quite a lot of research, policy work, and evaluations of programs and services. Our sort of main focus, though, which I think is quite unique in the mental health sector, is on tackling inequalities in mental health. So really thinking about like sort of intersecting needs that people might have, whether it's race and mental health, poverty and mental health, disability and mental health, and really trying to like get the system to respond in a much more sort of sophisticated and holistic way. So I sort of like look after our work on the young ones, children and young people, across like the ages of 0 to 25. And then the sort of like other hat that I wear, also at the center, we host something that's called the Children and Young People's Mental Health Coalition. Really long title, trying to find
that
a way.
Sounds strong. I love that. It sounds strong. I love the name. The coalition at the end,
Yeah. And like, it's been around for like 12 years. And it's basically like a network of over 250 organizations, which is just like incredible that we've got such a huge number of members. But basically, we just kind of come together to campaign on issues relating to children, young people's mental health. And like, we started off 12 years ago with like 28 members, and like now this is how many members we have, just because it just kind of like highlights how much mental health has like shot up the agenda. And it's not just mental health organizations who are interested, it's like, you know, youth charities, health charities, schools, lots of different sort of spaces and people.
I know our mental health, our counselor, sorry, at school is really, really busy, especially after COVID. It's like she's got a team of about 3 or 4 people that she works with, and they're all like full on all the time. And I think there's been so many safeguarding issues with regards to mental health after COVID, and that just highlights the importance of the work that you do, because there needs to be the different stakeholders who are going to look after the young people. Schools alone can't do it all, can it?
No, absolutely. And I think like for me, like most adult mental health problems first start in childhood, but we don't actually as a society do enough to like support children and young people. And then we kind of wait until people are like really unwell or like require long-term medication treatment or are in hospitals.
It's it's that whole reactive versus proactive thing, isn't it, Kadra? Yeah. Because, you know, I think one of the things I know from my work that I do in the professional sector with, around sport and physical activity, when we focus on children, young people now, I'm really pleased to see that social prescribing is such a big, you know, a big point and something that is getting there. It's something that hopefully, and for listeners who aren't familiar with social prescribing, so the same way that you might go to the doctor and be prescribed antidepressants, or you might be described, you know, antibiotics or whatever it might be, in the same breath, you can get prescribed activity, for instance, to be more physically active, which would then be, so let's say you would be signposted to local activities or clubs or things that would be suitable to help develop your physical, social and mental health. So, and I think that's so crucial for young people, right? Because it just, it takes away that whole, the only way you're going to get better is through something medical.
Yeah, and I think we've made such a, as a society, we've evolved quite a bit with regards to mental health, because I was having a conversation with one auntie a couple of weeks ago, and it was talking about, we were talking about this young person's mental health, whereas before it was like, oh yeah, you need to go and read the Quran, or yeah, you need to get closer to God, but we're now acknowledging it. So I feel like we're making the right steps in the right directions. I feel like with the elders, they don't necessarily know how to deal with those situations. So it's about having that dialogue, right? This is the issue. We've acknowledged it. How do we now move on? And I guess that brings me on to the next, my next point was, I've come across the one of the programs that you've been involved with called Shifting the Dial. I just wanted for you to tell us a little bit more about that. What impact has it had?
Yeah, so Shifting the Dial is like a three-year program that was based in Birmingham that focused on like preventing and preventing mental ill health and promoting the well-being of young Black men who are between the ages of like 16 to 25 in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And really, like, the reason why that program was set up is because all the evidence basically tells us that like Black boys at the ages of 11 are not much more likely to experience a mental health problem than their white counterparts. Mm-hmm. But then what we see in the mental health system is a huge like overrepresentation of Black young men mm-hmm. at the age of 18. So it's like, yeah, what happens all of a sudden as soon as they turn 18 that, you know, they're presenting with really like crisis, like.
Sorry to put you on the spot, Kadra. Why do you think that is from your perspective in the field?
Well, I mean, in short, I would say racism and discrimination and the fact that people aren't willing to like really understand the needs of Black children generally, because I think the education system, for example, fails them quite a lot, and there's like a more punitive response given to their mental health needs rather than actually like trying to understand what's driving this behavior. Could it be an emotional need that is not, you know, being addressed? So yeah, so that the program kind of was set up to like shift the dial basically in that sense. And basically actually what you said is kind of what they do is like the program like offers a range of like activities for young Black men to engage in. So for example, there's Lightpost Theatre Company, which is like a theatre company run by and for young Black men where they like explore well-being and mental health through theatre productions that they all, you know, create. So in an ideal world, we would like GPs to like refer young Black men who come to them to spaces like that. There's another project called Dear Youngers that's run by First Class Foundation, and they like offer peer mentoring, outreach support, development and skill kind of development sessions. So it's about giving young Black men from all different walks of life, like different options.
I love that. Yeah. And I remember doing some projects before with kind of adolescents. Again, mine was obviously linked to physical activity, but when we were looking at kind of how to, what is crucial to kind of signposting and actually gaining trust for young people to get out to activities that we know will improve their holistic health. And a lot of the time, you know, we see centres like amazing charities like Mind, you know, who set up, you know, good mood cafes and other things like that, which for some people works, absolutely. Mm. But one of the things I found really interesting was the fact that at the end of the day, mental health is about talking, right? So it's about being able to feel that you can get something off your chest, you can talk, you can share maybe a problem with a trusted individual. And within the Black community, do you know one of the biggest places that always came up where it was like, do you know what? I fully trust this person and they're going to talk.
Let me guess.
Go ahead.
Is it the hairdressers?
It is, honestly, literally your hairdresser, your barber, like, because you're sat there for time, you're literally sat there and you have nothing else to do but to talk, right? And you have to trust that person, best believe. So yeah, and I just thought, you know what, like, we need to help with the workforce, those people who are in those positions where they've got so much contact time with young people and with adults to understand, actually to spot those signs, which I just found really interesting.
Just on that, I remember going to my hairdresser quite recent actually, and she was talking about how they think that she's like a therapist, like her clients, everybody just comes there with all their issues, and I was like, I've literally just done that.
Offloaded, you're like, I'm guilty.
Oh, I do it to my nail lady all the time as well. Because you're sat there for ages, it's like, well...
But it's like, also there's that kind of like, well, I've got that trust with you because you ain't going to mash up my hair, but also, or nails in this case, but also like they're that step removed that they don't know you like that. So it's not, you know, where you might not want to take something to a friend or to a family member, you know, like it is a safe space. Ultimately, don't get me wrong. Like there may be some times where you feel, because we know how it is. Sometimes if you're in a big salon, it can be a bit gossipy and whatever. Yeah. But for the most part, you know, you can just chat to them, which sometimes is just all people need, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, no, exactly. And like that Day Youngers project, one of the interesting things they do is like the space is like designed in a culturally sensitive way and with the young Black men. So quite a lot of the young men who engage in that project are from Caribbean backgrounds. So they kind of have like the layout of the space as like a Caribbean family, like front room.
Nice.
They had to explain all this to me because I was like, there was like in Caribbean culture, like our front rooms is just like, it's a big thing. And it kind of like, you know what your grandma's house looks like with the cupboards and all the glassware and everything. Kind
the
of
the plates that never get used.
You know, souvenirs, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it felt like warm, inviting, you know, having the food that the young men enjoy, all these things is like things that just make them feel very comfortable so that they can open up really with one another.
It's that familiarity, isn't it? Like we all feel it, like regardless of whether we are, you know, we feel as though we are struggling with our mental health or not, like at the end of the day, if I've got a problem, I'm going to go somewhere that I feel safe psychologically, and to the person has to be crucial in protecting me, in protecting my peace. So I think that's beautiful that they've acknowledged that, they've noted down that the young people need that to be able to feel comfortable.
That's the next step, isn't it? I love that. Absolutely beautiful idea.
So speaking of next step, nicely lined in there, Ray. Kadra, in an ideal world, so we're thinking, imagine anything is possible. Yeah. All right. What initiatives do you feel are imperative to improving the mental health of the Black community?
I think firstly, I guess, is psychoeducation is like really key. I think there's lots of like myths about different kind of mental health conditions. And especially, for example, in my community, which is like also quite religious, you know, there's all like, oh, you know, this is like devil influence or whatever, and it's like, actually no, it's just a chemical thing. There's a reason, but, you know, you can kind of like really scientifically unpack some of that. So I think you know, we need like greater sort of visibility, and it's starting to happen, of people within our community sharing their stories and their experiences, and like especially I think I would say with young people, so that more young people can come forward and seek help. Again, I just like prevention is key to me, like prevention's better than cure. So I think, you know, just really like assessing the different assets that we have already within our community. And COVID has like really shown us that in some ways, because like faith organizations, for example, they really played such a massive role in like the vaccination program and all these kind of things. So like you said, you know, your hairdressers, your faith leader, the people
already in our community who are influential. I think, you know, if there's some sort of like mental health awareness training and stuff that we can really promote, and also learn from them, you know, like what are people coming to you with, what sort of information and support do you need to like signpost people, because they are also doing this as well. So yeah, I think I just would like to see the rebalancing of a from like a crisis driven response to more prevention, but then equally some people really do need that proper hospital care and stuff, and I would want for them to have like more culturally competent support. That means that they spend less time in care, because quite often like the black people spend longer time in mental health hospitals compared to like other communities as well. So I think, you know, finding out what works, because we're just taking a sort of colorblind approach to mental health at the moment, which isn't great.
Yeah. And I think what you said there about the kind of faith versus science is, it's a hard one. You know, it's not an easy thing to tackle, because I think particularly for young people, if you've been brought up in a household, the emphasis is on the Bible, the Quran, whatever it might be, and actually that has been your bread and butter. It's really, really challenging to then switch that up and be told, you know, because like you say, the family members may see, look, if you maybe are struggling, let's say a young person actually finds out they're diagnosed with bipolar or schizophrenia, actually, you know, that's going to be seen as that, you know, something's being taken hold of them, and maybe they're rejected from the household, or they can't open up and get the help that they need. And I think it was on a previous episode we did about postnatal depression, and Simone Riley, BBC Radio Manchester presenter, she was talking about her journey with, you know, actually, from a Caribbean perspective, you know, some of her family members were just like, you know, what's going on with you? Like, what's happening? Like, you know, and it's just so blasé. And I think particularly with the older generation, if, you know, because it's not been talked about in their time, because it was a, you know what, like, just pull your socks up, that kind of mentality. We hear strong black women all the time in association with the community. So I think that faith versus science bit is a real, I think it's a real crucial battle that we need to tackle somehow. I don't know how.
Yeah, it's so stigmatized as well. And it can be isolated as well. Because I remember back in back home in Zanzibar, we had an uncle. I think it was like my dad's cousin or someone who was quite close. And he'd be like, he was diagnosed with some sort of mental illness. Well, he wasn't diagnosed. They just thought he had some sort of mental illness. And he was literally just locked up in a room all day. I'm not even exaggerating, like just in a room on his own. And then he'll come out for a bit of fresh air and then he just goes back in. It's quite isolating and it's just so difficult.
Yeah, no, I've heard of numerous examples like that, even here, you know, in the UK, which is really sad. But I think for me, it comes down to like a little bit of ignorance in some ways, because actually in all of the holy books, I'm sure, you know, there are numerous sort of like references to like, whether it's Abraham, Jesus, Muhammad, like practicing things like mindfulness, but you know, it's not written in that way. So you would hear, you know, some scriptures where they're maybe reflecting on something and going for a walk and like cooling down. Those are things, it's all to do with mental health, but you know, people, because it doesn't have the label of mental health, they don't really recognize it. So I think, you know, there are like lots more sort of like better educated theologists than me in this space who can like really pull out these things, and there is also like community groups who religious groups who've produced great content around mental health, but I think that needs to be maybe like communicated and spread a bit more widely.
100%. Just moving on to the next point then, we're talking about role models. Why do you think they're important to young black men and women and their mental health? And did you have any personally growing up, did you have any, or currently do you have any role models? Who are those people and how were they influential? Sorry, that was very loaded.
That's okay. I think role models, right, I find it quite an interesting one, because a lot of people think, oh, role models, you have to think of like someone famous or somebody like, I don't know, was a president or something.
Barack Obama, he always comes up, this guy.
I know. And, you know, there's so many, like, role models we come into contact with every day in our lives. in our communities, in our families, and that sort of thing. So I think, yeah, I think like we need to like redefine what role models are, firstly. Sure. And what I find really interesting with this generation of young people, actually, I'm like a millennial, and maybe most of our role models were celebrities and people like that. But I think social media has changed the game and has like really, you know, there's normal people who are now like influencers that young people look up to a lot more and resonate with a lot more. So especially around like things to do with mental health, lots of there's lots of like influencers on YouTube, TikTok, all these spaces who are talking about their experiences and sharing their tips, sharing their advice, you know, engaging with their communities. And those are the people young people look up to more rather than what adults think, like, you know, find a celebrity person to like front this campaign. It's like, they are so aware of how far apart their worlds are, if you see what I mean. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I feel like it's slightly changed that, you know, they are in many ways looking up to like more younger people in their proximity.
Yeah,
in terms of mine, as cheesy as it is, I will say my mom. Because you know, she's just amazing, and she's been like a social worker for like over like 25 years or so. So I think like my passion for working with young people probably comes from her. But you know, she's a very strong woman, which again, it's not a term that I like to use often for Black women especially, but like, you know, she came here as like a young refugee by herself. She's got you know, she's partially sighted, so she's like registered blind, and despite all those things, like, she still is like so resilient and like keeps going and gives back so much to like the community, to young people and that sort of thing. So yeah, I want
to
be like,
shout out to mama. It's not cheesy though, because I think, you know, ultimately those that are closest to us are those that kind of help guide our path, right? So whether that's a family member or a friend or a guardian or whoever that is, I think that's where it starts, in the home, in school. And I think exactly what you said, Kadra, about social media, because even through Melanin and me, we post kind of motivational quotes and stuff kind of sporadically throughout our timeline. And I think, you know, from a perspective of somebody who, I've had kind of mental health challenges in the past, as we all have. And I think that just sometimes having that little inspiration or that little nugget or little boost to get you through the day. And one of the things that I really love, and it seems to be quite common amongst many platforms now, is just like top tips. So like, even if it's mindfulness tips, like things you could do today to kind of have a breath, take a breath, you know, and it might be going out for a walk or read a book, or, you know, just sit and have a warm cup of tea or coffee. And I think that those things, because people are scrolling through their feed, it's kind of, it's being consumed, and people can know, actually, do you know what, I'm gonna go to X page because maybe, you know, it makes me feel more welcome, it makes me feel less isolated. There's a page that I follow which is something about introverts, and because as much as I'm a people person and love being like out and about and socializing and talking to people, I know that I'm one of those people that needs to recharge my batteries. So yeah, she's great, she's got her hands up. Like I need that time, like that self-care time, to just be like, okay, now. So like when lockdown came, I was like, oh, this is you know.
I
had so many people telling me like, oh, really struggling. I'm just like, I'm having
this is great. I was like, I can deep condition my hair most days. I'm like, I can not wear makeup, I can wear baggy trousers and just do whatever I want in the comfort of my home. So yeah, I feel you. And it's just silly things like that, when you see kind of quotes or like posts that are about, you know, like just even silly little jokes or silly little things, because again, it makes you not feel as though there's a disparity between you and the rest of society. Like, why don't I want to, you know, why is it that I've got these great plans and actually I'm really feeling anxious about them? I'm not looking forward to them, or I'm worried about, you know, being in a social environment with a group and you don't really want to talk. It's not something you really talk about, but just that, like you say, that exposure, it can really make a big difference.
My my first sort of like moment where I sat down and I was like, oh, I need to like make sure that I make time for my mental health was Brian, actually, my mentor. Shout out Brian. Yeah, so whenever we sit down, he'll be like, so how are you, Ray? And I will literally talk for like half an hour about how I am. But then at the end, he'll always be like, so how are you filling your emotional tank then? And I was
yes, Brian.
I was. So from then on, I've been like, right, although I'm going to the gym and being active and being physically fit, I also need to look after this other element, which was quite interesting. And that was an interesting journey.
Yeah. No, exactly. And you know, what I really appreciate about all these tips and stuff, there's just like hundreds and hundreds, like what works for one person, what works for like Ashley might not work for you, Ray. And, you know, you have to kind of like do what makes you feel happy and comfortable and confident.
Definitely.
Definitely. So Kadra, how do we nurture an environment for ourselves, but also for our families and our friends to ensure that healed trauma becomes the norm? Big question.
That is a big question. I guess I think like, you know, trauma informed is a bit of like a buzzword at the moment. And that means, you know, in the first place, like designing our environments, our communities, our spaces in a way that recognizes these things. I think it's really difficult because like awareness of this generally is quite low. Like a lot of people are so aware of like how like abuse is a big thing and it harms people, but often like the emotional impact is not really what something people really think about. So it's really hard. I would always say, like, first of all, if anyone's in that position, like definitely seek like professional support and help. And then, you know, if you feel you have the sort of like, if you feel like you're in a space where you can kind of connect and share with your loved ones, then, you know, also starting to have those conversations, let them know about things they might be doing or things around the house, for example, that might be triggering. It might be a picture, who knows, you know, it's so it's so individual, everybody's own experiences of these things. So I think like just really open and honest conversations is like quite key. But I definitely would say it's really difficult because the first step to kind of like creating this environment is like, you know, processing it with sort of like professional advice and guidance is my first sort of, you know, step that I would encourage everyone to do. And then from there on, I think it's like quite intuitive. Again, like mental health is like not a linear or static thing. Like it changes all the time. So, you know, I think, you know, like we discussed just now, practicing self-care, especially, you know, for example, if you've lost a loved one and it's approaching the anniversary of a death or something like that, you know, just being really intentional about your what you are doing around that time and really factoring in that space for like reflection, for self-care, all of these types of things.
And you know, I think the self-care bit is part of that, is just giving yourself the time and space to feel the emotion, right? So one of my phrases of the year that I've stuck by is you got to feel it to heal it, right? So I think that absolutely prioritizing that self-care time. And we talked, so when we're talking about family, I think one of the things that we are almost like trying to is we're trying to fast track being better. Yeah. So we're trying to suppress that emotion. So let's say it's grief, or let's say something happens. It might be abuse in the household, for instance. That whole sweep it under the carpet, let's pretend like it didn't happen. So therefore, that person, that child, you know, adolescent, adult even, will suppress that emotion. And let's face it, it's going to come out one way or another at some point in life. So let's not beat around the bush or delay it any longer. Yeah. You know, let's address what we need to.
Yeah. I mean, we're all carrying baggage, aren't we? We're all walking around with like unresolved trauma. But I think the main thing is like, you know, you can only control yourself. And like, that's why I always say it's so important for you to like get the help you need. And then if there's other family members or people who also need to go through that process, encouraging them to do it. But I think it's kind of hard to like expect people who aren't aware of like the problems you might be experiencing or who aren't professionals to like know instantly sort of what to do, if you see what I mean. So that's quite challenging, I would say.
As a community as well, I feel like we need to do better at, even if somebody's seeking help, for us to support that movement rather than being like, you're wasting money. Well, no, I'm not, because I'm healing and I'm getting better. So we need to flip that around. Yeah.
Reframe the conversation. And, you know, one of the previous episodes, and we've talked about it a couple of times, come up is the Safe Spaces for Black Women community, that the group. I know, Ray, you've enjoyed that. So yeah. Those sessions and loved every minute. And I think if there are people on here who, because again, I think it's, as you say, professional help cadre, like it takes place in so many different forms, whether that is sort of, you know, an individual, let's say a therapist or a counselor, and you have that one-to-one contact time. It could be group sessions, it could be virtual, it could be face-to-face, it could be, you know, that sort of more therapeutic activities, which are, they're not things that maybe feel as though they're directly, you know, it's not a sit down on a sofa kind of in the movies where you're lying there and, you know, someone's got a notepad and paper, but, you know, it's safe areas where they're facilitated, they've got professional help there, which then if you want to talk, you can as well. I know one of the providers that I worked with through some of the programs that we set up for sporting activities for teenagers, some of the best sessions were, there was a group called MindFit. And they had a PT who would do some sessions with the kids, and they had a mental health specialist at the session. Wow. So they both get involved. There's also a male female kind of balance as well. And they know they can chat to either or if they want to, but they're also just getting fit and loving life at the same time. So yeah, we need more of that, I think.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds sick. Kadra, coming back to you then, if you can give us three top tips on how we can improve our mental health so we can live a more fulfilled life. Any of your personal top three favorites?
Yeah, I think, I guess lately I would say creating boundaries is a big one.
Yes.
I hate saying no to people, and I hate making people upset, or I feel like I make people upset, but they are upset themselves. That's what I need to remind myself. It's not me making them feel anyway. So I think, you know, just being able to like say no and put yourself first and be a little bit selfish.
You know, you
have to do it, because if not, you will burn out, run yourself to the ground.
Ash's favorite quotes. Something about people who don't know the boundaries. So the givers.
Givers need to set boundaries because takers don't. Yeah. And it's funny because Ray and I will often have multiple conversations on the phone and be like, oh man, we've got this thing, you know, like I'm really not feeling it. I've had a long week. This is probably not, I know I can G myself up. And we literally like pep talk each other like, look, if it was the other way around, what would you tell me to do? Stay home, keep your ass at home. Like, you know, because you're going to save yourself money, you're going to save yourself time and energy. You're not going to regret it. So it is one of those things where you always think worst case scenario. What if this person, how many times, right, has someone cancelled on you?
And
instead of being like, what is happening? Like, why, how are they letting me down? Have you been like, oh, thank God.
Yeah. It happens, definitely. I think it's kind of interesting, right? It's like, I know I need to say no, but I also have bad FOMO.
Yeah.
When I see pictures and stuff later, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I should go there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, no, you
can't. I hear that. I tend to now give myself a 24-hour rule. So if somebody asks me to do something, I'm like, oh, let me check, or let me get back to you on it. I'll let you know in the morning or whatever, because it gives me time to actually like think about it. Because I know impulsive, I'm just like, yeah, sure, why not? Yeah, great, wonderful. So that's my little trick, if that helps anyone.
No, that's a good idea. I kind of use that for shopping. So if I like something, I'm trying not to impulsively shop as well. So I'm like, think about it for like, not 24 hours, but think about it for a bit. And if you really, really want it, then.
Yeah, you know. Good. Love that.
So it's the boundaries, basically. first one, I think like this year, I've really been like trying to get back into my reading.
Nice.
I think like that just makes me just feel so calm, especially on like a Sunday, like evening. I'm like, no TV after 5-6 o'clock, and I'm so just gonna just get into my reading and actually reading relevant stuff to do with like my culture, my identity, not all necessarily like deep stuff and like racism and stuff. I think I did quite a lot of that in 2020. I'm like, I'm done reading.
Yeah. We all felt that.
You know, like there's amazing like fictional books, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read my sister the serial killer, hilarious. I'm reading a book called The Fortune Man, which is based on a true story but it's fictional. Unlike the last, actually it's kind of dark in a way, but it's the last black man who was executed in the UK was a Somali man in Wales, in Cardiff, and he was accused of murder and he didn't do it. So ooh. That kind of sparked a lot of change. But anyway, interesting read. And, you know, I don't know, the writer just writes in a way that you just feel like you're seeing everything. Like,
sure.
It really helps, I don't know, with like, I'm not... In my day job, I don't get to do anything that's creative or anything like that, really. Mm. So, you know, just bringing back imagination and creating these scenarios in your head through reading books. And then the last thing, I think for me, like, again, many people, my fitness during COVID, like, plummeted. And I was a gym girl. I was at the gym, like, 5 days a week, like, really trying to take weightlifting actually quite seriously before the pandemic. And then it just like my whole routine and everything flipped upside down. And yeah, I put on like a lot of weight. It just made me really sad and depressed. And I wasn't moving, I wasn't doing anything. So I made like a commitment to myself to like get moving again this year. Mm-hmm. And again, just the wonders that a little bit of movement does for your, the way that you feel, your well-being, especially if you do it, I feel personally in the morning. The rest of your day just feels like really quite, I don't know, upbeat, positive and energized, I would say. So yeah, and I'm always like keen to get more women into weightlifting and stuff. So
We have a weightlifter in our hands. Woo! Love it. I'm
a really weak baby weightlifter at the moment, but we'll get there.
Nice, love that. I do CrossFit, so whenever I hear people weightlifting, I'm like, yes, let's go and weightlift.
I love the fact that it's quite, you know, they're quite different things that you like to apply different tips, because it's almost like, you know, the movement bit is the kind of get up and about, you know, the kind of reading is that, okay, let's wind down, but the setting boundaries is more about that social aspect. And I think the thing, you know, like you said about the weight gain and the kind of fitness for you feeling like that plummeted, Kadra, I think with regards to how we talk to ourselves as well, like I remember feeling exactly the same. I was like, why can't I get back into a routine? Why can't I do this? And I think the pandemic, we underestimated the impact this had on us and we didn't see it coming. And you know, we talk about being kind to ourselves and all of this, and it is very, very hard because, you know, we live in a world where everything's instant. So for us to take those baby steps, it can be quite challenging because you think, oh my goodness, like the journey feels so far ahead. But me and Ray were talking about this the other day actually on the phone, because Ray's got some exciting stuff coming up, and I don't want to spoil it. So she's got a big tick list of stuff to do, and she's like, oh, I haven't done this. I was like, tell me what you have done, because, you know, just like we have a to-do list, give yourself a ta-da list so you can shout about and remind yourself all the things that you've done, because we don't do that, right?
Yeah,
I love that, a ta-da list. I'm gonna incorporate that.
honestly it was somebody at work, I think, who introduced me to it. And it was like, because even at work, you're always like going for, at the end of the day, your to-do list never ends. Like you never get to the bottom of it where there's zero stuff to do, whether that's around the house or whatever. But actually, if you go through your day and you really reflect on, oh my goodness, you know, even if it's just you put some laundry on or you took a really important call and you made a next step for something, you know, just those small steps and being mindful of those can just shift your mind frame for the day, I think.
Yeah. No, I love that. And it's just to say also, this week it's been really difficult because like the government introduced like some new requirements for restaurants to like put calorie labels on menus and stuff. So just to kind of say, like, on this topic at the moment, on foods, diet, health and stuff, it's a very difficult and sensitive time. And, you know, I don't think like that's the right solution for it. Like, I definitely agree with you. You do have to be kind to yourself and like create those like milestones for yourself that's not based on like measures or weights and stuff like that. So that's why for me, like, the weightlifting thing is like, I just want to be strong as well. I don't really
yeah,
I'm not focusing on as much how I look, but like getting stronger makes me feel like mentally stronger in a way as well. So, you know, thinking about your goals in a slightly different way and not these kind of metrics that, you know, perpetuate eating problems, especially amongst women, and that also affects Black women too, and
absolutely, a lot of
people don't think it does.
Has anybody seen that the video on Instagram that's been going around where this lady's like, when you fry plantain, this is how many calories there
I haven't seen this.
Oh my god, it's hilarious. So this lady comes on and she's like, did you know if you fry a plantain, this is how many calories there is in a plantain? And somebody comes in like, why are you ruining everything
for us?
Yeah.
You need to send me this. I'm intrigued. I'm very intrigued.
I'll find it.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is bliss. Let's just enjoy it. Please.
Who wants the air fried plantain? Like,
come on, no. About sauteed plantain. No, sorry. No. So Kadra, this is going to be like a bit of a mouthful for me, because I'm going to share an extract that was from The Guardian. Keen to get your thoughts on it as kind of the last like big question we've got for you today. So in The Guardian, it was from a mental health manager who said, little is known about Black women and mental health, as these individuals have been largely absent from research. The majority of the research has looked at ethnic minorities as a whole, rather than providing a focus on the challenges faced by Black women specifically. So we've touched on briefly the tackling inequalities agenda. What does this quote say to you, and how do you feel that we can bridge this gap to elevate the importance of Black and POC female mental health?
Yeah, well, I 100% agree with that assessment in that quote. I think it's like just such an underexplored area. And I'm trying to get some research off the ground in the space as well, I'm trying to look for money. So if any funders out there, just give me
hello, hello.
Yeah, but you know, it's okay. So I can speak mainly from a young person's perspective, but like the research on young people, it tells us, according to the government's own data, that Black children present with the lowest levels of mental health problems. That girls represent, like, you know, are disproportionately much more likely to experience mental health problems. So it's something like 1 in 4 teenage girls. And then I asked them, so what's the data for Black teenage girls? Because you're saying we're overrepresented when it comes to gender, but then not race. So we're in research, basically, and in services. I would say Black women of color are just completely invisible. First of all, nobody really recognizes like the intersection of like sexism and racism and how that like really impacts women's well-being.
Sure.
We know, I think there's some interesting work happening in other spaces, like Black maternal mental health and Black maternal deaths, because that's where a lot of this data started to come from. And then people are like, oh, so, you know, if Black women are facing much more complications during pregnancy or during birth, what's that doing to their mental health as well? So there's some conversations in that sort of space, but on the whole, I just think there's not really enough recognition out there. Some amazing organizations like Milk and Honeybees, I don't know if you guys have come across them, but they're a charity dedicated to Black girls and young women. And
nice.
Ebonita Ayiri, who leads it, is just amazing. I always love to like share their work, but I think there needs to be more organizations like that where people have that really intersectional understanding of mental health needs. And yeah, it's really difficult, because I think when it comes to race, and it is important, people focus a lot more on men, and then like women are sort of like completely like ignored or like overshadowed in some ways. But I think women of color and Black women in particular, we're like the backbone of our communities and our societies, and we're the ones often like harboring, you know, all the sort of like pain and hurt within our families and in our communities, and we're basically like suffering in silence. So it's very, very difficult. And I think, you know, to me, it comes down to like breaking down some of these tropes, such as like a strong Black woman, Black excellence, all these things. It's like kind of great, I get it, but they're also to our detriment. We don't need to be like super perfect and all these things as well. So I think, you know, I'm all for more mediocre Black women in senior positions. Like, why do we?
Exactly. I love that, mediocre. Yeah, like, can we just be average? Can we not be like these amazing, like,
I know it's hard for
all
us
the time.
obviously, yeah. I think that, like, what you were touching on there, Kadra, like, it's really interesting because it's almost like similar to the support and help. It goes back to that crisis thing again, isn't it? Like, it's almost it's not until, because we realize that male suicide, like the figures are so high, that then that's elevated in the conversation. But that doesn't stop women having those challenges, you know, just because it's higher, it doesn't stop that demographic. And I think, you know, when we talk about things like, you talked about pregnancy and death during childbirth and things like that, again, there's such a correlation between all of these. There's interdependencies, we know, you know, if you've, it's not seeing these things in isolation, but unfortunately a lot of, whether it's a charity or whether it's research, does tend to just isolate it on that one particular thing. So I think it's really important, as you say, for us to consider actually the holistic, wider impact on other areas and not just be so pigeonholed into we're honing in on this one topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, is it Malcolm X who said that Black women are like the most disrespected people in the world? And it kind of shows itself. So, you know, in terms of our interactions with people at work, it's just so difficult for Black women to maneuver that. There's the imposter syndrome of being a woman and being Black. It's kind of like doubled, all these kind of things. So I just think across the spectrum, like, just more needs to be done. And what I would love is for Black women actually leading the research and the interventions and developing these things. I think that's important as well.
Absolutely.
Amazing. How old are you, Kadra, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm gonna be 32 in a couple weeks.
No way. I genuinely thought you was about 23.
Really? Oh
yeah,
no,
honestly,
sorry, my cheeks.
Well, because my next question was gonna be, what advice would you give your 15-year-old self? But then I was like, you look so young. Think back a couple years back.
The way that Ray's basically telling you, you look 15. Ray, come on.
She looks young though.
Yeah.
So, no, do you know what I get all the time, don't worry.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, youthful face. Oh, that's why.
Black damn crack. what advice would you give your 15-year-old self then, if you were to think back a few years back?
I guess I would say take risks in terms of like your choices and stuff. I think, you know, especially in the British education system, like, presents all like our life choices as like being static, linear. You can only take this track. And actually, I didn't know that I would be doing what I do today when I was 15. Yeah. And it's only because I took risks. I tried things. If I didn't like it, I moved on, tried something else. So I think, yeah, don't be afraid to put yourself out there, especially for all the introverts.
Amazing. Thank you for your advice.
Right. You knew this was coming. We told you, we prepped you. Top three songs. So for listeners who are maybe new or aren't familiar or aware, we have a Melanin and Me playlist, which is on Apple Music and Spotify. Am I right in thinking? Or just Apple Music?
Apple Music.
Yeah, we have a very diverse collection. It's got a good range. We like to think it's one of those where you could probably, if you're going on a commute, you're going to get a bit of something, you know, if you're going to be driving somewhere, or if you're doing the housework, pop it on. I often put it on when I'm, you know, pottering around the house. So Kadra is going to add her three songs. Go ahead, tell us what they are.
Okay, this was a difficult choice, but I kind of thought about the songs that I was listening to last night, maybe the most. So these are mostly my sort of gym songs, I guess. But first one would be Jay Haas, Triumph. Nice. I really liked his album from 2019. So.
Yeah,
every song on the album, and then I don't know what the next two say about there's this sort of new Afrobeats artist called Amari, and I liked her song Sad Girls Love Money. Yeah.
there's no judgments here, Kadra, trust me, there's no judgments here.
Yeah, you should see Ash's playlist.
Hey, I've got plenty of Spice Girls, leave me.
Yeah, and I think kind of sticking in the same sort of like genre in some ways, but I really love Thames as well. So I would say Thames Replay.
Nice. Yes. What a tune. Sweet. Awesome. I was just capturing those and writing those down. Lovely. We'll add those to the playlist. And please do have a listen when you have a bit of time. It's been a wonderful pleasure having you on Melanin and Me. It's been absolutely fantastic. You've been a breath of fresh air.
Oh no, thank you. Love chatting to you both.
So that's a wrap on today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it and that you gained something positive from listening in, whether that be you gained a new perspective, got some tips and tricks to motivate and inspire you, or it's just made you smile. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, and leave a review so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes, and so we can bring you more of the content that you love. Until next time, stay blessed, wear that crown with pride, and keep shining.